Welcome to the Tax Institute's new monthly series, Tax Insights. Each month, you will be hearing from Senior Advocate of the Tax Institute, Robin Jacobson, taking you through the key matters that the Tax Policy and Advocacy team have in their sights. Here's Robin to explain more.
Hello, and welcome to our monthly series, Tax Insights. I'm Robin Jacobson, the Senior Advocate at the Tax Institute. Each month, I shall be discussing the key matters that are in our sights at the Tax Institute's Tax Policy and Advocacy team. This presentation draws content from the monthly tax update materials, and the page references are included on each slide. This month, I shall discuss the key measures from the Federal Budget 21-22. I'm also going to work through two pieces of exposure draft legislation, exempting granny flats from capital gains tax, and a new FBT exemption for employer-provided retraining and reskilling benefits. We'll have a look at some updated timeframes for director identification numbers, a couple of private binding rulings, and finally an update following the APTED decision and an updated practice statement. So firstly to the federal budget. And in this presentation, I've classified a number of the key tax and superannuation measures into various categories, the first being measures that are long overdue. Now, the detail of each of these measures is set out in our federal budget report, which is available on the member portal, and also discussed in two key post-budget webinars that we ran on Wednesday the 12th and Thursday the 13th of May. Again, these are available through your member portal. So based on that very comprehensive coverage in the report and those webinars, I'll keep my comments brief here. Firstly, the removal of the exclusion of the first $250 of self-education expenses is long overdue. Now, this is a legacy from even the 1960s, the 1970s, and then finally the removal of what was then a $250 rebate in the 1980s, has left a legacy of this $250 exclusion for self-ed. So very pleasing to see that this will be removed, but likely not before 1 July 2022. Another very long overdue and sensible measure is the removal of the $450 income threshold for superannuation guarantee purposes. This is the threshold below which an employer doesn't have a liability for the superannuation guarantee charge if they fail to provide employer superannuation support if the employee earns less than $450 in the month. It has disadvantaged a lot of low-income earners, as many as 300,000. And these people will now become entitled to super support. It harks back to a time when we used to make payments of contributions by cheque, and if someone earned, say, $100 in the month, then the contribution was between $5 and $10, and these amounts were a bit of a nuisance to pay by manual payment. But in an era of electronic payments, Superstream, and single-touch payroll, there's really no excuse for all of these tax employees, and particularly low-income earners, receiving requisite support. To clarify, there's been no mention that the under 18 rule is going to be amended in any way. So my reading of this is that if you are a part-time employee under 18 years of age, you will continue to be exempt from SG. Another sensible measure is the proposed removal of the active member test. Now, this is a test that says of all the active members in a super fund, those who are actively contributing, at least half of the benefits by dollar value must relate to resident members. Now, in larger funds, this is hardly an issue. But when we're talking self-managed funds or small APRA funds, the fact that, say, the two members in the fund can temporarily move overseas means that they are unable to contribute to their fund during this period. So this means that people who have been temporarily displaced overseas, but perhaps for extended periods, will be able to continue to contribute to their fund without setting up a superannuation account in a larger fund. Now, coupled with this measure is the proposal to increase the temporary absence rule for trustees of funds, again being self-managed or small APRA funds, where the central management and control is temporarily overseas. There is currently a 2-year period that is permitted. This will be increased up to 5 years. And again, as a sensible acknowledgement of people who have been displaced due to the international border closure. All of these superannuation measures will apply from the 1st 1 July following Royal Assent of the enabling legislation, and this is not expected to be until at least 1 July 2022. So this bunch of budget measures, I have categorised them as welcome measures that do not go far enough. Now the first one relates to the work test. Until 1 July 2020, someone aged 65 to 74 had to satisfy the work test to make voluntary contributions to super. Since 1 July 2020, that age is 67 to 74. Now, announced in the budget is the proposed removal of the work test for these people, that is, those aged 67 to 74, who make voluntary non-concessional contributions or voluntary concessional contributions through a salary sacrifice arrangement. This is indeed a very welcome measure, but it doesn't go far enough because it's not going to assist those individuals who are unable to access salary sacrifice arrangements. More broadly, those who are not employees. So anyone who earns, say, investment income and is not an employee, they don't have access to a salary sacrifice arrangement. So these people won't be able to make personal deductible contributions unless they continue to satisfy the work test. At a time when we should be doing whatever we can to encourage people to contribute to super, it would be good to see the complete removal of the work test for all individuals. The next measure relates to the full expensing of depreciating assets, and I'm going to couple this with the loss carryback measure, both of which were going to end effectively 2022. Both these measures will be extended for a further 12 months. So that means that a business with an aggregated turnover of less than $5 billion will be able to fully expense an asset that is first held after 7:30 p.m. on the 6th of October 2020 and held and first used or installed ready for use by June 30, 2023. As far as loss carryback is concerned, this is available to corporate tax entities only, so companies, and they will be able to claim back a loss in their 21, 22 or 23 tax return in respect of losses made from the 20 to the 23 income year in respect of tax paid on profits from the 19 to the 22 income years. Now, it does get a bit messy looking at which year do you claim the tax offset, which year are you carrying back the loss in respect of, and which year you've paid the profit. So do ensure you get that right. But certainly this is a welcome measure. Why doesn't it go far enough? Because it would be really good to see this being made a permanent feature of our tax system, a bit like what a number of other OECD countries do. And to the last item, a patent box. This is an unusual term, but it refers to a tax concession whereby income derived from Australian patents in the medical and biotechnology sectors will be taxed at the concessional rate of 17% rather than 25% if the entity is a base rate entity, or 30% otherwise. Now, this is a very welcome measure, but why does it not go far enough? Because there's scope for this to be expanded to other sectors. The government has already flagged that the clean energy sector could be ideal for this, but there are countless others that would also benefit from this concession. The concession will take effect from the 22-23 income year, so that's 1 July 2022, subject to the passage of legislation. On to a group of measures that I have termed awaiting further detail. The first one relates to the proposed new corporate tax residency test. You may recall in last year's budget, the government said that they would introduce a new test to determine whether a company is resident in Australia for tax purposes. If a company is incorporated in Australia, it is an Australian tax resident. If it's incorporated overseas, it can still be a tax resident if, according to the proposed test, the company has a significant economic connection to Australia. The budget announcement on the 11th of May this year is that this test will be expanded to also include trusts and corporate limited partnerships. We're still waiting for the amending legislation on this measure. When it comes to the individual tax residency rules, we're all familiar with the resides test and the three statutory tests, the domicile test for outward bound taxpayers, the 183-day rule for people inward bound into Australia, and the superannuation test. The reason for the change here results from a review by the Board of Taxation, which in 2019 finalised its report and recommended to the government that the rules be replaced with a new primary test, a bright line test. Bright line refers to the fact that a line is drawn, and if you're one side of it, there is one tax outcome, and if you're the other side of it, there is another tax outcome. Under the bright line test, an individual who resides in Australia for at least 183 days, that's physically present in Australia, would be taken to be a tax resident. If they don't satisfy the bright line test, there would be a secondary test based on four factors. Now, this would be the right to reside permanently in Australia, Australian accommodation, Australian family, and Australian economic connections. Now, in most cases, it's going to be relatively straightforward to determine whether someone is a citizen of Australia or has a permanent residency visa, where their accommodation is and where their family is based. But I can see in some situations, measuring the Australian economic connections could be more subjective, harder to measure, and is likely to lead to the seeking of clarification or interpretation by the courts. Some guidance by the ATO may even be necessary. So we certainly welcome further consultation on the operation of this new bright line test and the secondary factors test. If we just go back to what's prompted all this, the removal of 23AG of the 36 Act with effect 1 July 2009 has sparked a massive increase in litigation by people who were previously exempt from their foreign employment income to tax in Australia. Now, from 1930 to 2009, an academic at Sydney University has tracked that there were 25 cases in that 79-year period on individual tax residency. However, in the 10 years from 2010 to 2020, there were 56 cases. So there's been a massive increase in the amount of litigation in this area. And the thinking behind the introduction of this bright line test is that some of that uncertainty and even litigation can be reduced. The government is also going to introduce a new 30% digital games tax offset. Now, this is being marketed to those who are trying to break into the $250 billion global games development market. Who knew that it was that big? This will provide a 30% refundable tax offset for businesses that spend at least $500,000 on eligible gaming expenditure, an offset of no more than $20 million. If there is a gambling element, then that sort of gaming expenditure would not be eligible for this tax offset. So again, another very welcome development, but further detail is needed about its implementation and operation. And lastly, a bundle of other measures which are notable from the budget this year. Firstly, the downsizer contributions. So where you sell an ownership interest in a dwelling that is eligible for a full or partial main residence exemption, and you've continuously held that ownership interest for at least 10 years, and you're at least 65 years of age, you can make up to $300,000 in downsizer contributions. From the 1st of July, following Royal Assent to the enabling legislation, expected to be no earlier than 1 July 2022, we are going to see the reduction of the eligible age from 65 down to 60. At the other end of the age and housing market spectrum, first home buyers. There is no change to the annual limit of $15,000 that can be contributed to a first home super saver account. However, there is a proposed increase in the maximum releasable amount. Currently $30,000, this is expected to increase to $50,000. There'll also be the opportunity for the first time to self-assess the effective lives of intangible assets, namely patents, registered designs, copyright, and in-house software. Currently under section 40-95, subsection 7 of the 97 Act, there are prescribed statutory lives for depreciating these assets. This is optional, so if you'd like to continue to depreciate the asset using the statutory effective life, then you may continue to do so. But if you'd like to self-assess, then this option will now be available. If you're sensing a bit of deja vu here, you are quite correct, because in 2017, the government attempted to bring in measures to allow you to self-assess the effective life of intangible assets. The measures were removed from the bill before it was enacted in 2019 and ultimately were never implemented. So basically the government's picking up on a measure from some years ago, and hopefully this time round it will move through the parliament. Into the employee share scheme provisions, and one of the current taxing points for deferred employee share scheme interest and the taxation on that deferral is going to be removed. That is, the cessation of employment will no longer be a taxing point. So the tax on these interests will be deferred to the earliest of the remaining existing taxing points. Finally, the AAT will be given the power to pause or modify ATO debt recovery actions. Currently, if you are the subject of a debt recovery action, you need to go to the federal court to seek or apply for the pausing or modification of that ATO activity. So this will enable the AAT to have those powers and makes it far more affordable, both in terms of cost and time, for businesses to be able to seek some sort of relief or pausing of that ATO debt recovery action. This is expected to take effect from the date of rollercent. This will be available to small business entities only, that is with an aggregated turnover of less than $10 million, and they will be able to apply directly to the Small Business Taxation Division of the AAT to pause or modify the ATO debt recovery action until the underlying dispute is resolved by the AAT. Now, on to a measure that was announced in last year's federal budget, granny flat arrangements. So in this discussion, I'm going to refer to granny as the individual who is the beneficiary or recipient of the granny flat arrangement. And then we've got the property owner who owns the land on which the granny flat is being built. This is draft legislation released for comment on the 16th of April this year. The measures propose to insert new Division 137 into the 97 Tax Act. It will take effect from the 1 July following royal assent, so that is not expected to be any earlier than 1 July 2022. The measures will respond to a concern that the incidence of CGT on granny flat arrangements could be leading to elder abuse. Now, this is because such arrangements often involve the payment of a sum of money up front to construct the granny flat on the land of the property owner. This results in CGT event D1 happening, and this is one of those CGT events that is ineligible for the discount, so the whole amount effectively forms part of assessable income. As a result, there is a reluctance to document granny flat arrangements, and this can lead to elder abuse, including the eviction of the granny, the sale of the land leaving them homeless, or even accessing proceeds from the sale of granny's home, and there have been media reports of this occurring. So these amendments will ensure that a CGT event doesn't happen, which thereby removes the disincentive for documenting the arrangement. So you'll need to have what's called a granny flat interest in a dwelling, and this is an interest in a dwelling where the individual under that arrangement has a lifelong right to occupy the dwelling that is conferred by the arrangement. An individual will be eligible for a granny flat interest if they've reached pension age or they have a disability and they need assistance to carry out their day-to-day activities. There is no requirement that granny actually be a relative or in any way a family member of the property owner, although of course that would be expected to be the case in most situations. Notably, this measure will not alleviate the CGT liability that can still arise under section 118/190, where granny rents the flat. Of course, the use of a dwelling to produce income can result in a partial loss of main residence exemption, and these measures don't address that issue. They address solely the D1 event that can occur on the creation or modification or termination under C2 of such an interest. The CGT event is taken not to have happened once these measures are in place. Also on the 16th of April this year, the government released exposure draft legislation dealing with a proposed exemption in new 58ZE of the FBT Act. This is intended to apply to benefits provided on or after the 2nd of October last year, the date on which this measure was announced. The measure is designed to support and provide incentives to employers to retrain and reskill individuals so they're better able to transition to their next career. In particular, the FBT exemption will be available if an employer provides training or education to an employee who is redundant or soon to be redundant for the purpose of assisting them to gain new employment. Ordinarily, of course, this would be subject to FBT, but at a time where we're trying to reskill people, and particularly following the COVID-19 pandemic, where a lot of work has been rearranged and even displaced, this is an opportunity for an employer to support the retraining and reskilling of one of their employees or former employees. Notably, the employer must be satisfied that the training or education is being undertaken for them to earn or produce salary wages to which that educational training relates. So obviously any training or education of a personal nature or personal interest will not satisfy this test. So on to a couple of private binding rulings, and I thought these were particularly interesting issues. They're not new, but they're ones that come up repeatedly, particularly in the property sector. Now, this particular one relates to a subdivision of land and sale of the resulting dwellings that were constructed. The background was that the couple owned the property and it was their main residence before they moved overseas. Their son then lived in the property for a period. It was never rented out. While they were overseas, they decided that they would demolish their existing house, subdivide the land, and build a couple of new houses on it. These were sold immediately after construction. Now, generally, profits from property sales are assessable as ordinary income under Section 6(5) of the 97 Act, or as statutory income under the CGT provisions, again of the 97 Act. So where a profit has been made as a result of a taxpayer carrying on a business of property development, or as an isolated business transaction, in other words, a profit-making undertaking, then the profit is assessable as ordinary income on revenue account. Where the profit is merely a realisation of a capital asset, then the profit remains assessable as a capital gain under the CGT provisions. The extent of personal involvement of the taxpayer in the planning, organisation and management of the activities are significant factors as to whether a business has been carried out. Ruling TR 92(3) sets out the important factors to consider when determining whether profits from an isolated business transaction or a profit-making undertaking are assessable income on revenue account. The fact that the couple were residing overseas when the decision was made to subdivide the property was made, and that they did not return until the new properties were sold, indicated to the ATO that they had very little personal involvement in the organisation and management of the activities. So in this case, the sale proceeds were determined to be an isolated transaction on revenue account. This was more than just mere realisation, but it did fall short of carrying on a business. The couple had no previous history of property development transactions, although it was noted that should they repeat the activities, then the ATO would consider that this would morph into carrying on a business. The gains would still be assessable, but it would form part of the trading stock provisions. Noting also that the subdivision of land of itself does not give rise to a CGT event. The CGT event A1 happens on the sale of the lots. Now this gets quite complicated because you still make a capital gain on the sale of the lots, but you then reduce that capital gain to the extent that any of that profit is already assessable as ordinary income under Section 6(5). Now this is called the anti-overlap rule, and you'll find it in Section 118-20 of the 97 Act. There may also be a partial main residence exemption available for the period that the couple did reside in the property prior to venturing the property into this undertaking. Now at that point, you would generally need to acquire a market value because that then becomes the cost or the basis for working out the profit that is assessable on revenue account. This isn't really prescribed clearly in the law. The CGT provisions and the trading stock rules are quite clear, but this profit-making undertaking often causes concern for practitioners. So do ensure that you seek advice if you're struggling to understand it and make sure that you get it right for your client. In the second private binding ruling, this deals with the apportionment of rental income. So the facts are that A and B were married to each other and purchased property together as joint tenants. They then separated and since that time have been financially independent. When they separated, A&B entered into an agreement to split the net rental income each month after the payment was received by the property agent and certain property expenses had been deducted. The agreement provided that B would receive X percent of the net rental income and A would get the rest. And the percentage split between A and B was not 50-50. So what we had was the property expenses being deducted from the rent. The rest of it was then being paid into their respective bank accounts, but in the proportions that they had separately agreed. A then sought to include the rental income she'd received in her tax return, which of course was less than the amount according to a 50-50 split. The Commissioner confirmed that income or losses from a rental property must be shared according to the legal interest of the owners, except in very limited circumstances where there is sufficient evidence to establish that the equitable interest in the property is different from the legal title. Now, joint tenants of a property are taken to hold equal legal interests, i.e. 50-50 if there are two of them, one third each if there are three of them, and so on. An agreement with an ex-spouse cannot alter or override respective interests in a property for income tax purposes. And no evidence was provided by these taxpayers that would establish that an equitable interest differed from the legal interest in that property. Accordingly, this was considered to be a 50-50 allocation for tax purposes, and therefore the amount that A was seeking to include would have been insufficient. Just a timely reminder that you need to ensure that the amounts reported in tax returns do reflect your actual legal interest in the property. Now, it is possible that through a tenant in common arrangement, you could have other than a 50-50 split for two property owners. But this would be reflected in the way that the property was purchased, or if the titles were subsequently amended to reflect tenants in common, there could be CGT implications, because this would be considered to be a disposal of a legal interest and the acquisition of a separate interest. So on to the final issue, a decision impact statement following the APTED decision in the full federal court and an updated practice statement, PSLA 2020/1. These were both issued on the 29th of April. Now the APTED decision I have covered in a couple of previous Tax Insight sessions, so you can refer back to those for the details of the case. But this related to whether a taxpayer was eligible for JobKeeper on the basis that he had applied for a reinstated ABN. It did not exist on the 12th of March 2020 as the law requires, but he did enable the retrospective reinstatement of that back to the 1st of July 2019. And the issue was whether the taxpayer should have been entitled to the exercise of the Commissioner's discretion to allow him more time to hold an ABN. Now, following the decision which went in favour of the taxpayer, the ATO now accepts that the discretion is broader than how it was applied in the APTED case originally. But notably, this discretion applies only for one of two reasons. That is, further time to hold an ABN or further time to provide notice to the Commissioner of assessable income or supplies to evidence your business activity prior to the 12th of March 2020. Now, this is not a free-for-all. Certainly, there is scope for potentially thousands of taxpayers to now be eligible for either JobKeeper on the basis of eligible business participants or for the cash flow boost. But even though the discretion could be exercised, the entity would still need to satisfy all of the basic conditions. The ATO has said through the decision impact statement that they will automatically review and contact entities who have previously received an adverse decision from the ATO in this regard. Now, if you feel that you have a client who hasn't been contacted by the ATO and does fit within the parameters of this decision and is on all fours with the decision in the case, then I encourage you to contact the ATO as soon as possible. They certainly would ask that people contact them before the end of May, and further guidance may be necessary, but certainly they can look at your case and determine whether discretion is appropriate. This should start to bring an end to the entire JobKeeper program and cash flow boost, and certainly the ATO is keen to start tying up the loose ends and moving back to business as usual for all the other taxation matters that we have to deal with. So that's all for this month. We look forward to bringing you more tax insights again next month.
Thanks, Robin, for your presentation. We trust today's insights have provided you with a valuable update. The Tax Institute is committed to providing members with timely and relevant content, and we look forward to engaging with you again next month.